Get ready for the O'Shelly Effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck O'Shelly, and he's been known for many years as a blind PFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
O'Kelly! April 16, 2020, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And yes, this is the show you were looking for because you found it. Anyway, it is a Thursday. Now, normally every other Thursday, we have Carmine Savastano with us, but I changed up the schedule because I wanted to get right on this very new book from the guy I had on last Thursday. Now, last Thursday, we talked about creating chaos. And you'll look in the archives, which, by the way, I'm slightly behind on because there's been website issues. So if you don't know why there isn't a show from Wednesday up yet, it is because of that. But anyway, that is being resolved. And later on tonight, we should be getting caught up and get this show out, early tomorrow. Anyway, all of that aside, let's get to the business of the day. This new book from the guy I had on last week, Larry Hancock, is coming out, well, tomorrow, actually, in the physical version of it, right? I think you can get the ebook version right now if you go to Amazon. I'll give you the link to it. All that, and it's called In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Okay? And the tanks thing, we've heard about airstrikes when it comes to the whole Bay of Pigs thing, right? And yes, I did quote it that way for a reason. But anyway, we've heard about this. I never heard about the tanks. And Larry Hancock has written about quite a bit in here that, quite frankly, I was telling him before we went to air, is so diversely sourced. I don't think I've ever seen a book of his on a narrow topic anyway, because this is a narrow topic, that is so, I don't know, it just provides a grand cross-section of sources. I'll give you an example here. You have the HSCA, and you're going to have to reference that when you want to talk about Cuba, because there's some tangential things that connect this. Of course, the HSCA, half of it anyway, spent a lot of time on the Kennedy administration, so they were quite occupied with the issue of Cuba, so therefore it has to come up there. Okay, fine. You say, well, Church Committee, we know about that, and we've gone over a lot of this stuff, like the official investigations and so on, in the JFK 101 series. But I see references in here for H.P. Alborelli's book. Okay, and the really good one that I've talked about on the show before, A Terrible Mistake, which explains some things about the CIA that you might have not heard before, if you don't know that book. I mean, but also Inspector General's reports, various other investigations, some sources that I was not familiar with at all, to be honest with you, on this subject, and I've been over this subject. A lot of people have. But I don't think it's been treated in this way, in depth, and there are brand new, well, readings of history here in this book, In Denial. So, like I said, Larry Hancock's with me, larry-hancock.com. Go there, you can see the blog, you can see the many books, and Larry's written a bunch of them. They're all great, they're all good. Not a bad one in the bunch. Unidentified, Someone Would Have Talked, you've got Surprise Attack, you've got, like we talked about, Creating Chaos. I'm not going to mention them all because I want to get right to this book. And it would take me a while to list everything and explain all of his books. But if you go to larry-hancock.com, you can look into it as well. And my voice is still a little off. I'm still a little weak, but I am back to myself. So anyway, Larry, first of all, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, thanks. Happy to be at this point, having the book become available after 3 years. You heave a great sigh of relief when it finally goes out there.
Well, and this is, you know, not a short read, really. I'll tell you that. I mean, I'm not saying it, look, that's not a criticism. There is a purpose to every page here that I've gotten through, and here we go again. I've gotten halfway through the book, and I'm talking to Larry, but quite honestly, I think I'm going to want to revisit this with you, this book anyway, so when I get finished with it, we're going to have more to talk about, and who knows, maybe you can spoil a few things for me, but still I want to watch your process. Because here's an interesting thing about Larry's writing style, is that you can follow the process by which the ideas are developed. A lot of times people write about subjects like this, and you don't hear, or you don't see, or you don't end up, how should I put this, gathering the knowledge from which a lot of their statements are made. You see a grandiose statement and a couple of pieces of carefully selected evidence, maybe, put in the book to support it. And that's it. You move on. And then you'll see the statement again, and, you know, they might as well just say, see my other statement. Because that's all they're doing is repeating stuff about what they conclude regarding an event, an individual, a circumstance. Larry doesn't do that. You can actually see where it came from. You know, I don't know. Larry, I don't think I could ever write a book this well-sourced. I don't think I'd have the patience to do it. And even though it's a powerful tool, actually, for the reader, I don't know that I could ever complete this if I was given 3 years or 13 years, Larry. I don't know. This is remarkable in that way all the way across so far. As I said, I'm like, you know, 280 pages in, something like that. How many pages is it altogether?
With the index, it's about 475.
Okay, 475. So I am more than halfway through. But even so, I'm telling you, there is a lot here. It's not a light read. But it's also, you know, it might seem like a slog to some people, but if you're actually interested in this subject, you know, I don't think I could have asked you for anything else here, Larry. You went back over territory that other people have, but you managed not to bore me to death, because this could easily be boring to somebody who's had to study these sorts of things, you know, at least at certain times. Regarding the JFK assassination. So, you know, it's well written. It's well sourced. It's a hell of a book. So, you know, a sigh of relief for you, but a sigh of relief for me that somebody is still writing an intelligent literature that's even remotely connected to the, you know, I hate to say this, it's remotely connected to the JFK universe of literature. Which, you know, some people could take as a compliment or a curse, I guess, coming out of my mouth. But quite frankly, this is, you know, a reference book and a read. And, again, I'm just really overwhelmed and impressed by the cross-section of information and how you source this. And so let's begin. What made you decide to cover, you know, again, the operations in Cuba, the campaign against Cuba, the, you know, various types, the diversified warfare, if you will, that went on between Cuba and the United States? What made you even decide to tackle this yet again?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think the book itself is essentially two books. We talked about creating chaos last week, and one of my goals in that book was to look at political warfare in the last century and kind of come up with a paradigm for it, and look at this century and see if things had changed. And as we discussed last week, they have. Cold War political warfare and 21st century political warfare are not the same in either the players or the exact tools. The tactics, yeah, they stay the same. Right. And so I sat back and I said, well, you know, I want to take a look and see if that applies to secret warfare, covert warfare. Has it changed? And that was the theme of this book, because I'd written another book on how you do covert warfare. That was Shadow Warfare, how the U.S. does covert warfare.
Right.
And so that one approach in this book, In Denial, is just simply to look at deniable warfare and say, is it going on now in the 21st century the same as it did in the 20th century? And so that's one cut of the book, and that's covered. And actually, most of that is in the second half that you haven't gotten to yet, comparing the two.
Okay.
But in doing that, people need to have a really good model, a really detailed operational model, if we're going to compare deniable warfare. And what jumps out at you is the most sensational failure of deniable warfare were the landings in Cuba, the Bay of Pigs. I mean, that's what everybody thinks about. How can you screw something up worse than that? It was a disaster. Most people blame it on JFK. Certainly the Cuban community blames it on JFK. The CI officers in the field at the time did. And so it's also really important to the history of the Kennedy administration.
It is important to the history of the Kennedy administration, but it's also important to people who study the assassination. Why? Because some people have turned it into the motivating factor where they're looking for the Cubans in Dealey Plaza, basically. And they say that it is because of the Bay of Pigs. I mean, this is a common thread theme that runs through, I mean, I hate to say this, but even through Judy Baker's stuff, right? Where, you know, it's got something to do with the Cubans, and obviously it has something to do with not only the missile crisis, but the Bay of Pigs and the failure there. And those two things are certainly related, okay? But the concept that this might have been one of the primary motivations for the assassins to operate and all that makes it a centerpiece topic, which is funny because I don't think it's ever been really properly handled all the way through. People have picked it apart and talked about it and then gone on to attach it to, well, this is why, you know, Cubans would be involved in the assassination. And then they go from there. Or they point it out and they say, well, this is, you know, the grudge that formed between the CIA and Kennedy. And therefore, the CIA has a motivation to kill him. He fired, even in Oliver Stone's film, right? He fired Alan Dulles over this, which really is not technically true, but it did have something to do with Alan Dulles's departure as the head of the CIA, right? So there's a lot there that somebody could say is important, not only to the overall historical record regarding that time period, the Kennedy administration, but also it's sort of like this generator of ideas in the Kennedy assassination field too, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I'm afraid a lot of people have written about not just about motive, okay, but have been written about names and generalized about people without really knowing who was involved in the Cuba Project. And I think one thing we're really happy about, and I've certainly had people working with me on this book, is this: the Cuba Project and Bay of Pigs part of this book introduced us to a particular group of people that we had really never known before. And to a name, for example, you know, you'll recall, Chuck, how excited we were back, you know, the HSCA wouldn't even admit that David Morales worked for the CIA when Fonzie brought it up. And Morales has become kind of a major figure of interest. Well, there's another name that emerges in this that's actually a far more operational name. The guy that was associated with the Castro sniper assassination operations that nobody had ever really talked about before. And it's been fascinating to learn about this guy named Carl Jenkins, who was far and away more operationally important than David Morales ever was, both during the Cuba Project and in 1963. And so this is,
Yeah,
it's exposed names and people and associations we just didn't have before.
Well, right. I'll tell you a name that usually doesn't come up in other people's works on this is Barnes. You know, and see, now I bet you somebody who's listening and who is familiar with this might say, Barnes, who is that? Because, you know, tell us about Barnes. There's a non-Cuban name, right? That, you know, they'll talk to us about how Dulles was here and, you know, and Bissell, and we've heard of J.C. King, and we've heard of, you know what I'm saying? But what about Barnes?
Well, and what we've learned, Barnes and Bissell, just to set the stage for talking about the Cuba Project, mm-hmm. It was a very strangely organized project. Bissell, Deputy Director of Plans Operations, was picked to lead the project, but he actually was put in paired with J.C. King, who was in charge of the Western Hemisphere. It's probably the most poorly structured organization that anyone could ever come up with. But reporting to Bissell for the project was Tracy Barnes, okay? Mm-hmm. And Tracy Barnes had some really important experience. The Cuba Project, as it was laid out and developed only over a two-month period of time by Barnes, was essentially modeled off Guatemala and the CIA success in Guatemala. And Barnes and Bissell set it up that way. So throughout the whole life of the project, over 12 months, Barnes and Bissell are the guy who are driving it at headquarters in Washington, D.C., where the guys that are actually in charge over time of making it happen are two other field officers. They're really three field officers that get involved. One CI officer named Jake Easterline, a Marine officer who's assigned very late in the game called Jack Hawkins, and this Carl Jenkins, who is the senior trainer and field officer. And, of course, another major player comes in who's Rip Robertson, which some people may have thought, you know, Rip Robertson was, you know, a low-level figure that we've been interested in. He's much more significant figure in the Cuba Project than anyone would have ever imagined. So there are players here and relationships here that get to be really key. And I know it's hard to jump right into it, but to relate it back to something you just said, Chuck, we've always thought about motive and that the Cubans were told and came to believe that they had been betrayed by JFK. And one of the reasons this book is so deeply referenced is that's not true. That is false history. And that's what led me to substantiate it in so much detail because of work some other people done as well as myself. That Jack Hawkins and Jake Easterline carried that story to Miami after the disaster at the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. And essentially told all the Cubans they'd worked with how badly they had been betrayed by the White House. What they didn't realize, and they only realized decades later when they were shown the actual documents, that it was not Kennedy who had betrayed them and not Kennedy who had lied to them, but rather they had been directly lied to by their boss, Richard Bissell. And I quote it in the book and give their quotes. When they look at the actual documents and what was going on, and by the way, they were kept out of the meetings where this stuff was being discussed. They were flabbergasted. They were irate. And basically they said, he lied to us and we lied to the Cubans.
Right.
And we didn't know it.
Well, see, now there's the interesting part of this, because generally the story has been told that, look, the CIA misrepresented this. And, I mean, you know, documentaries, books, so on and so forth. I could probably find 100 places where effectively this short story is told. The CIA misled Kennedy. Kennedy then did not know what to do. And to avoid engaging in something that could become a much worse international incident, allowed these Cubans, which were there, placed there by the United States, but not fully supported, to basically fall on their swords on the beach, okay, at the Bay of Pigs. And he did that and had to live with that, and that was one of those things. Big failure, early part of his presidency, and people have made a lot of assertions after that. But the point is, this is usually the beginning of one of those stories, right? And the idea that, you know, Dulles misrepresented it to Kennedy, I'm not objecting to. But, you know, but where does the actual truth of this lie as far as what did Kennedy know, what could he have known? And perhaps Alan Dulles didn't have a full handle on this. Because
Alan Dulles didn't have a full handle on it. Mm-hmm. You're getting into the meat of the meat of it is that nobody had a full handle on it except possibly Bissell. And he was telling one story up the chain of command and another story down the chain of command.
Mm-hmm. See, now that's interesting because one would say, well, look, you know, these things in real time, Larry, right? There are going to be, well, false reports that are going to emerge either through incompetence, an incomplete set of data. You know, certain things don't become known until later because you have to collect the information, so on and so forth, right? But here's the interesting thing. The documentation that you come up with reveals that not only was there problems with the organization, but there were problems with the plan. There were problems with the story afterwards going out, like you said, into Miami. Okay, let me tell these guys who are waiting for good results from the Bay of Pigs why it failed. But even after, long after, you have no way of really sorting this out if you're looking at official sources. And the rumors, speculation, and everything else that was generated off of this mythos make it an almost incomprehensible historical event. Like, you know, like
it was. It was. You describe exactly where I was sitting here, where at the table where I am now, 2 years ago, and I'm looking at four different sources. I'm looking at the IG report, After Action report, the Bissell Barnes rebuttal to that, saying, no, we certainly didn't mismanage it as badly as you say we did. The Taylor Commission report that says something different, and then essentially the years later, the CIA historians report, and I'm looking at all four of them together and going, then it doesn't fit. You know, I'm going to have to bat this stuff together for months and months and months because they don't align anywhere.
Well, to make that even worse, we discussed the Church Committee in depth on this show. Right. And look, there. This is where usually people go, well, that's when we learned about this, the public, you know, and it's like, OK, maybe. But quite frankly, they didn't even give an answer that fits together with any of those other pieces, really, when it came to this event at all. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that, but it seems to me like the Church Committee didn't really reveal this contradictory story. I mean, yes, it peeled back. You know, it's sort of like picking at a scab and only getting part of the scab off, you know, and now you got a combination going on here. And it's like that's what the Church Committee actually did regarding this event, right? They went into other things as they should have, and they certainly were interesting in their time period, as we discussed, right? But they didn't get to, like, you know, go to this and sort it out and say, okay, now that we've gotten a chance to look at this, you know, long after the fact, you know, Kennedy's gone. Anybody who was in power is basically not in power anymore except, well, you know, the guy that we got a call to testify. But, right?
I think there's a really good illustration of that. One of the things that they did get right, and they got it so right that we figured we had the full story. Mm-hmm. I mean, they put together a very solid story of the poison attempts. Right. Okay, yes, there was a plan to assassinate Castro. It involved Johnny Roselli. It involved some humid casino figures and some attempts to poison Castro, which were in play for about 9 months before they finally tried to bring them off only weeks before the landings. And because we had that story, it's like, okay, yeah, they tried to, so someone would say, oh, well, yeah, they tried to assassinate Castro, and you would think you knew the whole story. Even the church committee, after questioning Johnny Roselli, realized that there were two phases to all this, and that Roselli had talked to them about the poison, but Roselli had not talked to them about the other things that were going on, and we now know it. The same time the poison plan was trying to be executed, there was a series of other plans in play, sniper attacks on Castro, which we knew nothing about. The church committee knew nothing about. The HSCA actually uncovered some evidence of it, but they couldn't connect it to anything.
Right. It was just one of these floating things. And here's the odd thing about that is even to this day, Larry, I cannot recall another author really writing as much as you did about the sniper plans. I've seen it mentioned pretty much, you know, where it's like, well, this also might have been going on too, along with, and then we get into the more sensational aspects of it, and a lot of people that, you know, have the mob did it sort of mentality about the Kennedy assassination, focus on it briefly and then gone. That's the end of it. Yeah.
I need to give a great deal of credit to David Boylan, who worked documents with me, Bill Simpich. If we had not been able to break a number of the crypts that were in use in these documents, and we cite documents that nobody ever looked at before, you wouldn't have known what was going on, but we're now able to trace the training of these special teams, the maritime infiltration teams that were separated out from the brigade, given special training at Belle Chasse in Louisiana, put into safe houses in Florida, launched on missions out of the Keys, and in those missions actually were used as covers for some of the sniper attacks. And we can tell you exactly which boat carried in on what mission Felix Rodriguez or Segundo Borges, who name you never heard of before, for these sniper attacks. It just, we were able to reduce it to a level of detail that was brand new to us.
Well, right. Now, Felix Rodriguez, like I said before, this is one of those names that comes up and is usually grouped in because, well, rightfully so. Right. Rodriguez is definitely somebody who would be in play for this whole situation, probably more than one way. But that's obscured a bit. And here's where I really want you to kick off your presentation, because I've kind of come at you with these questions and they're a little out of order, I think, for the listeners. So let's dial it back to what it is we're talking about, first of all. This whole, okay, we know about Batista falling, we know about, and usually, again, this is, a lot of this stuff is kind of well documented in some of those, you know, I'm going to eventually tell you the Mafia Killed JFK books, right? But there is a lot more to this, and, you know, who was it that the mob was working with, the CIA? Okay. Some people have turned that into, well, you know, they released certain information. The mob guys did. They would have never had the information to release. But anyway, the thing is that when you take it down to why this was launched in the first place, how about that? Why the Bay of Pigs? Why was this the idea to begin with?
Okay, and that's a great starting point because – and it helps in a very important division because – almost everybody thinks that the Bay of Pigs was the Cuba Project and the Bay of Pigs was the failure of the Cuba Project.
Right.
As it turns out, that's absolutely untrue. The Cuba Project, as it was originally conceived, planned, funded, and approved by President Eisenhower, has no shape or resemblance to what happened at the Bay of Pigs. Basically, the Eisenhower regime, just as it had, I mean, the Eisenhower regime and the U.S. in general during the 1950s and early 1960s with uncomfortable with any regime that was too nationalist or too populist or certainly did any business at all with the communist Eastern Bloc. Mm-hmm. So let's just say it started at a point in time where the CIA and the State Department determined that Castro fit that model. And the first proposal from the CIA came from J.C. King, who was in charge of the Western Hemisphere. And that makes sense because it's where QB is. J.C. King literally wrote a memo to Alan Dulles saying, let's kill him. And that was real straightforward. Let's just solve our problem. Let's eliminate him. And Dulles, thought that was a good idea, but the language a little strong. So he just changed the language a little bit and, sent it on up to Eisenhower and said, we need a project to remove him. Okay, fine. Eisenhower could understand that. He'd authorized those things before, and he pretty well trusted Dulles and the CIA on that sort of thing. So the strange thing, and it's important to remember, is that all of this occurred at the beginning of 1960, in the first months of 1960. And over a 2-3 month period, J.C. King handed over a project. And Barnes actually wrote a plan for the Cuba project, which was modeled, as I said, off Guatemala, off what they had done before. And it was really straightforward. It had about 4 major elements. There'd be a propaganda program. There'd be a political action program to recruit resistance political figures and put together, an opposition government. They'd collect intelligence on Castro's weaknesses. And they would put together a relatively small paramilitary cadre that was highly trained. And they would, we're talking about maybe 50 people, maybe 100 people. They would infiltrate them on the island to work with resistance groups. And it was felt there was enough opposition to Castro that would do it. And literally that plan said that by October, by following those 4 steps, there would be a major insurgency on the island. Before the November elections, there would be an insurgency, and the Castro regime would either be in grave trouble or would have already fallen. And so the original time frame was that the insurgency was supposed to be general on island in October, well over by November, and that was the timeline. And Eisenhower signed off on that, and went off and really didn't involve himself that much with the operation. He had other problems, including Laos, which he was really worried about,
right.
Southeast Asia. So without him getting...
Hold on really quick, because this is why Nixon is the executive action officer here. Because, his president, Nixon being vice president, Eisenhower did not involve himself directly in these things, right? So the liaison there becomes Nixon in this case. And
really, actually, so he basically, he doesn't get involved with these guys we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He just attends a few of the special group oversight meetings that just kind of say, how's the project going? So, yeah, as you say, he's in a liaison role and, he's just more or less reassuring, I'm sure. We don't really have much correspondence for him, but he appears to be just keeping Eisenhower comfortable that something's happening.
Well, right. I wanted to make that point, though, because a lot of people do make, Nixon was the mastermind of the Bay of Pigs. And it's like, I don't know where you're getting that from. And I always ask, he was the, I get he was the executive branch, highest up, governmental person that we know of. That was, in contact with the people that were running this. But I don't think that was that unusual, even when we take a look at, again, in context, you got Guatemala happening before this because there is a need to take action, thought of in those circles anyway, because of the close proximity of a possible hostile nation, right? So, of course it's logical that King is there to participate in this. Of course it's logical that there is some reaction in the Cold War stage we were at right there, which was, you know, fairly early on. But still, you know, so this actually all makes a lot of sense, except that I do want to make sure that we note that, you know, Nixon is not like, you know, the guy making plans or really giving orders. He is in just that liaison sort of role here, right?
He is, and he really, and people may not realize, the way this works is, you know, the president signs off on a proposal from the CIA. The CIA puts together a group to operationalize it. And during the life of that project, there's a special group, oversight committee, that does oversight of all these covert action projects. And more or less from a political standpoint, it's kind of like, oh, no, you really shouldn't use an atomic weapon. That's bad form. Or, no, don't fly the U-2 right over Havana. But it's very high level. Actually, the reason it's set up that way was the CIA tended to go overboard. So it gave the State Department and the military services, you know, it was a way to make sure that they had some idea of knowing what the CIA was doing, and maybe if they had a real problem with it, expressing it back up to the president. Mm-hmm. And those are the meetings that Nixon would have attended.
Right.
That's all he's going to see. He's going to see no operational detail, which explains why when we get along in this story to about September, Nixon goes absolutely ballistic, because he's been doing nothing to prepare a political campaign over Cuba, because he thinks it's a done deal. And when September and October, when this whole thing falls around and collapses, it's a shock to everybody, including him.
Well, right. And they're trying to gauge also what the public, you know, face of this is going to be, too, even though it's going to be handed over to possibly Kennedy or Nixon. Because here's the other part of it that comes up a little later as well. Kennedy was briefed on this before he took office. Nixon was already in the loop, so there had to be a public pronouncement of a face, so to speak, for what would be known publicly, right? I mean, the world, it's not the world of today where we'd have instantaneous reporting, but if Castro had been deposed, removed, eliminated, liquidated, pick a word, you know, the world would have noticed. And the United States would have made a statement. It might have been, you know, complete deniability because, well, these are Cuban nationals. They took their own action. Whatever. But they had to prepare for that. Right? I mean,
yeah.
And
they were in a bind. Eisenhower and Nixon were in kind of a bind. One of the political aspects of all this is during the whole campaign, JFK's formal avowed position was, we ought to be supporting the Cuban resistance against Fidel Castro, and we ought to be giving them aid and comfort and support in overthrowing him. That's Kennedy ran on that platform.
Right.
Nixon was sucked into the point of Eisenhower's, the administration thing was strict neutrality. So Nixon couldn't even say as much as Kennedy was saying. He couldn't say, oh, we need to support the Cuban resistance and have the president go, well, Mr. Vice President, you know, we are neutral in this, and that's the official State Department line. So he couldn't even do that, and that really irritated him. But all the time, we were actually doing pretty much little more than what Kennedy was saying that we should do. Because up until September, October, we weren't, you know, none of what we think of as the Bay of Pigs or the Cuban Expeditionary Force, none of that was in the cards. The only thing that had been added to the mix is along about July-August timeframe, it became clear that Castro was really being far more effective against the on-island resistance groups than they had hoped he would be. Mm-hmm. And so they did add to the plan that they were going to provide air support. They were going to provide, as they had in Guatemala, they were going to create a small revolutionary air force that would fly in and do ground support missions. You know, they could parachute in this cadre that was being trained, you know, like I said, maybe 100 guys, parachute them in. Right. And they could do airstrikes in support of the resistance movement. That, That's the only thing that was added to the whole plan up until November.
Well, I'll tell you what's fascinating. If you want to look at this, not you, Larry, I'm sure you've seen it, but you, the listener, I got a hold of the debates, the televised debates between Kennedy and Nixon some years ago on DVD from the National Archives, right? And I'm sure they're available online somewhere. Look them up. But, you know, the first televised debates, right? All right. Take a look at what happens when there's a question about Cuba. During those debates, you see Nixon, you know, some of his, you know, fumbling around that people talk about is during those questions. Because he's trying to maintain Eisenhower's line, you know, while running for president and seemingly not being quite sure what he should say a few times. Right? Because they've both been given some classified information at this point. And
all Kennedy knew was, he really did, he probably knew much the same. Oh, we're, and in fact, we know, looking at the briefings he was given that same thing. All he was told was, yeah, we are supporting the Cuban resistance groups. That's
right.
It.
Right. So, but I'm just saying there's a different attitude there. But, you know, when you said the, you know, the Eisenhower position was more about neutrality and Kennedy was saying, well, we should be aiding and supporting. You can literally watch the two different answers go on, though, and I swear that part of Nixon is sitting there trying to run in his mind, you know, where should I really go with this? No, because he does, right? I mean, you know
what I'm
talking about.
And you can kind of empathize with him. It's kind of like, this other guy is saying what I want to say, what I believe, and what we're doing, and I can't say that.
Well, right, because he has to be the guy who's going to carry the standard for Eisenhower going forward. We're going to keep going with the Eisenhower program, basically, was Nixon's thing when he ran in 1960. All right. And again, this is a very interesting time period because what was the date of the Bay of Pigs invasion?
I think it would be like April 17th.
So
1961.
Yeah, which means 3 months after Kennedy takes office. Could have been 3 months after Nixon takes office. Who knows what the public face of that would have been if Nixon was president, right? that would have been but either way, neither one of them had an advantage here. In reality, regardless of what it looked like publicly. And, you know, Kennedy talking about having to own it and everything else is interesting too, but I'm getting ahead in the story. Let's continue on with what was going on here. In order. Go ahead.
And I think that's one of the reasons why the book gets pretty dense at this point is that we really developed the whole schedule. You know, what were the training programs? What did they have to do to get do the paramilitary training? What did they have to do to get the propaganda going? The problems with the political action And the bottom line is, and it's really very strange, up to this point in time, and this is something Bissell made a big deal about, up to this time in previous covert actions, whether it had been Guatemala or Tibet or Indonesia, there had been no hesitancy to go about things in certain ways. For example, we used the military to supply resistance groups in Indonesia. We took stuff in by submarine, by Navy barges, by, you know, there was actually a major Navy mission going on taking stuff to resistance groups. We had no problem with just hiring contract pilots from Air America to fly attack missions in Guatemala. We outsourced all this stuff, and that worked really quickly. For some reason, Bissell made the decision, the special group somebody made the decisions, it's unclear, and Bissell didn't complain about it at the time, that we wouldn't do any of that in regard to Cuba. We would have to train everybody. We would have to create an Air Force. We'd have to train the Cubans. We'd have to supply the Cubans. We couldn't do it on American bases that existed. We'd have to build brand new bases overseas. So they spent months just constructing facilities, and and getting trainers, and that I go through this, you saw it in extreme detail, and just because of the approach that they took, things went far more slowly than they'd ever gone, and they got to, it's really ironic, they get to October, mid-October, and Jenkins at the military training base says, okay, we've got 100 people cadre trained, they're really good, they're solid, and we want you to, no, now's the time for the plan, let's put them into Cuba to lead these resistance groups. And headquarters comes by and says, well, we don't really, we can't do that because they don't have an air capability yet, and they have absolutely no maritime insertion capability. The only people, the only way they've been getting people on island is for several months they did it legally by sneaking them in with passports and visas just as commercial travelers. Mm-hmm. But they had no capability for military infiltration, and that's what, by November, they have to step back and go, you know, we just missed the boat. This is not going to happen. The whole project, literally, the timeline, time frame, and plan for an insurgency basically collapsed in November, and everybody went, what do we do now?
Right. Okay. Now, this is really fascinating, too, because in between then and the date when it goes down, there's a lot of interesting stuff that goes on here that's a little confusing, too. So, you know, I don't want you to reveal everything you have in the book, obviously. But, I mean, give us an idea of how this moves forward when you have this problem. Okay, so now we can't have, you know, ships that are under the flag or registered with the U.S. or, you know, we can't turn around and use military assets because that would be too overt an act. You know, all that going on. How do you get from November to, you know, to, well, what is it?
April, yeah.
5 months later, right? 5 months later, 6 months later. Either way.
And so what really happens is at this point in time, you know, Eisenhower suddenly realized the election was here and nothing had happened, and he begins to reassert himself in the process and raise questions, and they don't really have any good answers for him. And the special group doesn't have any answers at all because they're to oversee what's happening and nothing is happening. Okay.
Right.
So basically, Bissell and Barnes, regroup, and they have a planning session, and basically they have to face up to the harsh fact that Cuba is now armed and in a state of advanced security preparations, and what they were talking about just won't work. So what you see are dialogues and meetings through late November into December, and essentially everybody is coming into meetings and saying, well, we only have two choices. We're going to have to escalate this whole thing into a much better, bigger, larger, covert military action than we'd ever planned before. You know, maybe we don't need 100 cadre or 500 cadre. We need 1,500. We need 2,000. We need 3,000. We need a major armed force on island for it to succeed. And how do we do that? And actually, they bring in Marine colonel because they decide, you know, and also we've proven that we have no real air or maritime infiltration capability. What do? They bring in a Marine colonel named Jack Hawkins. And it's interesting to look at Hawkins says, you know, when I was assigned to this, the commandant of the Marine Corps said, oh, those CIA guys need to put some resistance fighters into Cuba. Go give him a hand. It's like, wait a minute. That doesn't exactly sound like conducting an amphibious landing, does it?
No, it doesn't.
that's what everybody was still thinking of in a way. But then suddenly you get to through December and they start floating this idea, Bissell and Barnes, based on consulting with Hawkins, and they essentially tell them, you know, a force, you know, the resistance is not going to use it, but we need a force of well-trained fighters that will stimulate an insurgency on the island. And if we can do that, we can put them on the island. They can start moving towards Havana. Everybody will fall in line. This just needs a stimulus to make it happen.
Okay, see, that's a key point, all right? And I want to pause here with you for a second because this is the overall concept that is usually discussed. The CIA felt as though if we drop these guys on the beach, I mean, I'm doing this in very, very, you know, street-level language, okay? But we drop these guys on the beach, the other Cubans that are on the island will join them and become a mass resistance. They themselves are not actually the military unit that's going to accomplish something. They're going to inspire the Cuban citizenry to rise up just by landing on this beach, where hardly anybody will see him anyway. But, you know, but this was like the plan all along is what most people think. And
that's the way everybody is talking in like December and January. That's like, okay, that's the plan.
Yeah, but that's a couple of months before. That's not, you know, that's not like when the Cuba project was launched. Here was the core idea.
Right.
You know, and that's another interesting point to this. So, you know, again, the Marine, he's a colonel, right?
Yes.
Who is there. Now, he's obviously going to try and show them a little command and control. You know, like, here's military discipline for you. Because I don't think this group of guys, I don't know what they were trained to do exactly outside of be infantrymen on a beach. What were they actually trained to do? Because that's the thing about this. If you're going to do that, then the Marines would be helpful in that they have skills and they have subsets of individuals who specialize in things like what? Landing on a beach. You know.
And you're raising a point that Kennedy was never told. For example, up until October, all the focus by Carl Jenkins and the trainers had been training, you know, a relatively small body of people, a few hundred guys, in paramilitary operations, infiltration, guerrilla action, communications, how to get these resistance groups going. Well, what happens by November, they pull those guys out, and they send them to Louisiana and Florida, and they start using them for different activities, and all these new recruits, the next 1,000 guys that they train, 1,200 guys that they train,
right,
are all trained as infantrymen to operate in standard infantry formation with tanks, heavy weapons. They have absolutely no guerrilla skills at all. And everybody from that point on will totally ignore that fact. When Kennedy asked them, well, if something goes bad, you know, then they'll just go into the mountains and they'll fight as guerrilla fighters. And everybody goes, yeah, sure, they'll do that, without having the faintest idea what they're talking about, and the fact that they would have had to abandon all their weapons. You know, we're talking about trucks and tanks and heavy mortars and heavy machine guns.
Right.
But oh, they'll leave that all in the beach, and they'll go into the mountains with what? What are they going to take?
The rifles,
you know,
they
sling. A rifle and 200 rounds of ammunition. Yeah, that'll help.
That's the thing, but here's the problem. In order to do that, you have to be familiar with, I'm going to go and be in the jungle, or I'm going to go and be in the swamp, or, you know, you're specifically trained for that. In the military. I mean, am I out of my mind here?
No. And the thing is that the few hundred people that they had trained for that,
mm-hmm,
were part of the brigade that was landed in Cuba. And as a matter of fact, were not even sent in to support it, which is a very strange point. All this training these guys to be infiltrated and lead resistance groups, none of that even happened in the area around the Bay of Pigs. There was no organized resistance in Ireland to support this group that was coming on the beaches. And I won't get started on it, but you're right, Chuck. This is where we start seeing the big disconnects at headquarters in Washington, D.C., with people talking about things that they really don't understand, and by February. Bissell is no longer letting Barnes and Hawkins participate in a lot of the meetings. And later on, Barnes realizes that he wasn't, because Barnes would have been raising flags all over the place. And it's getting in advance of the story, but actually weeks before the landing, both Hawkins and Easterline go to Bissell and say, it's a disaster. It's, you know, everything is going to fail, and tell him to call it off. So it wasn't that wasn't obvious to the military CIA guys, that it was going into deep problems in 1961. It wasn't, that was very obvious. It just didn't make it up the chain of command.
Well, see, but the thing is, if they went to Bissell, then it was his responsibility to, I mean, you know, just thinking about this logically, objectively, he should have put a stop to it because they weren't prepared. I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying it, but that's really what it comes down to. They don't have the assets to complete the mission. I mean, that's all there is to it, because
They don't, and they knew it. And you, so to just step back just a little bit, as soon as Hawkins came on board, yeah, one of the first issues he raised was the fact that there was a whole air element to this. There was a brigade air force of B-26 fighter bombers, ground attack aircraft. They weren't really fighters. The pilots were trained to do ground attacks to support, you know, what we were just talking about, to support resistance fighters or troops aground. And there was a transport group to parachute stuff in, and both of them had their problems. But Hawkins immediately realized the most fundamental problem was that they weren't going to be under his command. They reported to the CIA air group, which reported to Washington, D.C. He had charge of the Cuban Expeditionary Force. He had no control over the air element other than to send messages over and say, hey, could you guys do this and that? And maybe they would communicate it correctly, and maybe it would happen, and maybe it wouldn't happen.
Well, and, but strategically, that's the problem, is you need to be able to coordinate these forces. Otherwise, you know, what are you doing? The air group doesn't know where the troops are going, so they might inadvertently destroy the friendly troops. You have, you know, and the reverse here, where, okay, so the troops don't know where the air group is going again, and they may engage in something where now they put themselves in the line of fire. You need to be able to coordinate this, you know, very tightly in order to avoid problems like that. That's only one of the problems. But, I mean, how are you going to know where to drop stuff? You're talking about places where they could parachute things in. How are you going to know where to drop it unless somebody knows precisely how to explain to somebody up in the air, or how to explain to their commander, at least, where to put it? You know?
And as an illustration of that, you know, we jumped ahead a little bit there, but one of the core problems, it was only after the troops had been landed that everyone realized that there's a unit that normally would accompany a force like that. We refer them to them these days as forward air controllers, and they're on the ground and they're trained in how to call in airstrikes or supply drops. And they're on the radio with the air command, and they're coordinating these things, and they're pinpointing targets. Well, not only there were no people trained as beachmasters to land anything, there were no people trained as forward air controllers, and the radio communications channels that they were using, the equipment did not allow the people on the beach to communicate with the aircraft.
Uh-huh. Now, look.
So, it's hard to find worse command and control.
Right. Well, here's the thing. As we get ready to go to break, I'm going to give you the illustration to relate to you, the listener. If you've ever watched just about any Vietnam War movie where they show the army on the ground, you know, doing their thing, whatever that might be, depending on the director, who knows, right? There's always somebody grabbing off of a box that's on somebody's back, something that looks like a telephone, and basically calling in to tell them where to drop the napalm. That's a particular job in the military. This is a way to, you know, for you to relate to exactly what Larry's talking about, I think, in something that's very easily accessible. But there's a lot more to what went wrong, what was going to go wrong, and what continued to go wrong. And I think we're going to have to talk about the assets in the air a little more in the next hour. Larry Hancock is with me. The book is called In Denial. And don't worry, we'll give you the link to it and everything before the show is done. But we're going to take a little break and continue with this discussion. Again, the Ocelli Effect will be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Humans, their nature demands competition. The rising tide of aggression shaping the world around us. Natural fear and disgust can overcome the ability to reason. Coping skills are left wanting. Carmine Savastano, Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature, poses significant questions and considers the evidence that violence shapes the past and present. Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature. Order your digital and print copies now on Amazon.com. For more information, visit tpaak.com. Carmine Savastano, Human Time Bomb.
You will see drugs being used like nobody's ever used them before, and people are going to be dying all over the place from drug addiction. I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have large numbers of suicides. Take a look at what happens in a really horrible recession or worse. So you're going to have tremendous suicides. But you know what you're going to have more than anything else? Drug addiction. You will see drugs being used like nobody's ever used them before. And people are going to be dying all over the place from drug addiction.
Ocelli. Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now here at Ocelli.com. Of course, you're probably hearing this further on down the stream by your final slab of choice, your applicable application, etc., because most of our listeners are in podcast form. By the way, we are going back on YouTube automatically and all that again. Just restored that yesterday. A lot of other work gets done besides talking at the microphone, by the way, just so you know. But so the shows are back to regularly going up to YouTube and everything else. But meanwhile, that's not what we're here to discuss. We are discussing In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. And that is the latest book, which will be available in physical form tomorrow. But by the time you hear the podcast, it's out there. Go to Amazon, go get it, I guess. We're going to give them the Amazon link, right, Larry?
Yes.
Okay, so you can go to Amazon and go get it, Larry Hancock, or, hey, look, read up some other stuff that Larry's written, some of it out there for free on his blog. Go to Larry-Hancock.com, and you can follow through there, see all the books that Larry's written. Not a bad one in the bunch, folks, including The Awful Grace of God, which he co-authored, you know, Surprise Attack, Shadow Warfare. I don't know. I try to mention as many of your books as I can during the show, but I want to get back to this subject. Why? We were talking about the Bay of Pigs. We were talking about the airstrike aspect of it, the aerial assets. Oh, I don't know. Lots of names we could put on this, and I've heard people colorfully describe what went on there, including people like E. Howard Hunt and his supporters and the people that support the story that, oh, I don't know, oddly enough, revolves a bit around E. Howard Hunt and who he knew and everything else and what he knew and how he was a spy master and all that good stuff. Kind of fascinating, because if you take a look at what E. Howard Hunt said about this, if you take a look at what E. Howard Hunt allegedly said about this, you know, I come to one of two conclusions, as I told Larry off air, that either E. Howard Hunt was spinning a yarn of fiction out there for you for a purpose, or he didn't know very much. And, you know, I think both Larry and I agree that perhaps E. Howard Hunt did not know very much about the circumstances that were really at play at the Bay of Pigs. But back to it, part of his story, and part of the story that a lot of people discuss, even when they don't include Mr. Hunt, is the idea that JFK betrayed the Cubans. How did he do this? Because they were there, embattled upon, you know, on the beach. They were, you know, attempting to fight the good fight. And Kennedy refused to send in air support. He called off the airstrikes or refused to call them in or something like that. That was his betrayal. That's why they failed at the Bay of Pigs. That's why the, you know, stories about why the Cubans were spoiling for revenge, as Larry discussed in the first hour, we now know exactly where that yarn was first, oh, I don't know, manufactured. But let's get to the reality of this, Larry. What do we know regarding that part of the story that other people tell?
Yeah, well, one of the things we know is that Hunt wasn't directly involved in any of this. It's mm-hmm. sort of like David Phillips, a name that we all know, you know, is associated with the Cuba Project and the Bay of Pigs, and he was in charge of the propaganda effort and setting up radio stations, and I cover that all in the book.
Yeah, he was also involved in Guatemala, and yeah. It's not as though this kind of action would have been foreign to him in any way, shape, or form, but go ahead.
same thing for Hunt, who was involved. Basically, Phillips did propaganda activities. Hunt did political activities, which primarily meant liaison, trying to organize the various anti-Castro factions to work with each other into some sort of a regime that could be offered up as a competing government for Cuba. And that's what he did. And that was a very difficult job. Again, write about both of those at length in the book. And what did happen and what didn't happen. But none of those had anything to do with military operations. And certainly during the first phase, everything that Phillips would have expected to do to support an insurgency really failed because, as we just got through talking about, that insurgency didn't happen by November. Everything that he put in play to broadcast and propagandize about a resistance movement, as he had in Guatemala, where it had worked, did not work in Cuba. The same thing with Hunt. They were totally unable to form an effectual anti-Castro regime, and only managed to string the Cuban Revolutionary Council together in a very nominal fashion weeks before the landing at the Bay of Pigs. So one of the things that's very important of all of this, when you hear what these guys had to say, you have to map it to the overall evolution of what the Cuba Project was supposed to be versus the kind of Hail Mary amphibious landings that occurred 2 to 3 months after JFK had become involved in it in the first place. And to set the stage for the airstrikes, again, this is hugely convoluted because everybody seemed to have their own story, their own recommendations, their own compromises. But let's just put it this way, to put that to bed, a matter of weeks before the landings at the Bay of Pigs, Easterline and Hawkins, the two military commanders, went to Bissell and said, basically, the number and quantity of airstrikes that you have are totally insufficient. It's not going to work against the size of the Cuban force that's going to come against us and how quickly they're going to come against us. And even worse, you all don't seem to understand how exposed our landing ships are going to be at the bay. If we do not have utter total air control superiority over that landing, we will lose our ships and the whole thing will be dead in the water at that point in time. And they put it on the line to them and said, you've got to go back to JFK and get more air support, more airstrikes over a longer period of time. And I'm quoting them. I don't make this up. In interviews with them, basically, they laid it on the line. Bissell told them absolutely he would do that. They threatened to resign. He said, don't resign. I'll get you the support you need. He went back and essentially took the amount of air support that had already was in their plan that they were saying it was not enough and told JFK that they could cut it in half and never told that to Hawkins and Bissell. And this becomes a dreadful story when you lay it out day by day what they don't know. And they don't even find out the cuts that had been made until the mission itself sails, okay. Until the brigade sails.
Yeah, let me just make sure I heard you right, okay? Because it seems as though if you are organizing something and you're in the, you know, above the field commander level, your field commanders come to you and say, look, we don't have the adequate anything. It doesn't matter. Airstrikes, bullets, men, jeeps, whatever, right? You say, look, I don't have enough of these to pull off what you're asking me to do. And the guy says, okay, I heard you. I understand you. He literally goes to the guy over his head and says, yeah, give him half. So he cut in half what was already insufficient.
Yeah. And okay. I know this sounds like a very sensational claim, but I think we document that at great length in the book, both with what Easterline and Hawkins later said after they had reviewed actual documents and by other sources. We can show that the air command, for example, that when the brigade leaders Kennedy issued a directive to Bissell, that the Cuban force leaders would be told before they sailed that there would be no American air cover for them. Every bit of air cover they had to come from their own brigade, B-26s, and they were briefed on that. And there's a record of the briefing, and they were told it. So, you know, that now whether the average infantry person was told that or not, we have no way of knowing. The leaders were told, and there's a record of it. So as you trace this all down the line, gets to be very convoluted about who was told what when. And that's how some of this misinformation evolved. But basically the bottom line was the CIA was backed against a wall, and it was trying to do a major military amphibious landing covertly and do it with, and let's step back from this situation a little bit, Chuck, and talk about this. You know, Kennedy wants this to be deniable. He's ordered how long is, you know, Eisenhower said that the hand of the U.S. must never show in this project. Mm-hmm. Nobody can ever connect the U.S. to what we're doing in Cuba. Kennedy took the same position. You've got to have full deniability. This has to be totally a Cuban thing. Right. Yeah, you can have Cuban pilots flying Cuban aircraft. Do whatever you want to do with them. We're not committing any American pilots or any American aircraft. It made it very perfectly clear.
It cannot be seen.
While they're doing that, yeah, and he's telling them that, they're putting American Army tanks on the beach and not telling him.
Okay. It cannot be seen as an American invasion. This is basically the point, right? And how do you do that? How do you not see it as an American invasion? Well, you don't allow anything that is of American origin to make that first landing. That would be the, I mean, I know I'm again dragging this down to the very simplified level, but, you know, true or false. So you have to avoid using American planes because you don't want them spotted. You have to avoid using American ships that are clearly military, American origin ships. And meanwhile, they're putting tanks there.
And they're doing it with a plan. For example, Kennedy, and I won't go into the details between the Trinidad and plan and the Zapata plan, because there was a lot of debate. Kennedy kept telling them, you know, I told you what I want. I told you I just want you to land these people and infiltrate them so they can stimulate the resistance.
Right.
And they kept saying, yes, that's what we're doing. But at the same time, they're planning what's, you know, kind of a D-Day class landing with landing craft, command craft off the beach, tanks, trucks, heavy weapons, a parachute drop in conjunction with it, and they're landing on three different beaches at the same time, which is a very complex task. And by the way, they provide no landing masters to coordinate this. And actually, they're not supposed to be any Americans near the beachhead. As it turns out, there are two Americans who essentially take control of the operation who are not even supposed to be there,
uh-huh,
Lynn and Robertson. And they will tell you, we weren't supposed to be there. And they end up doing all the coordination because of what we said about the radio channels. The Cubans can communicate with them on their command landing craft. They communicate with the Navy, who communicates with Washington and the air units in Nicaragua. And the poor Cubans on the beach, the only contact they have with anybody is through these two CIA officers offshore in the command craft. That's it. And they're otherwise on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very difficult situation. But, okay, to take this one step further, one of the things you will see, and one of the reasons throughout the 3 days of the landing, Kennedy again and again backs off his positions. At first it was, well, you can't fly any missions with the American pilots. Then he authorizes American pilots to fly the B-26s because the Cubans have been flying so many missions they're exhausted. And they have aircraft and they don't have enough pilots. So he authorizes Americans to, and they actually do ground strikes with American pilots. He authorizes a lot of other missions, ground night attacks that don't work, but he authorizes a lot of attacks. Finally, in the end, Bissell is given the opportunity to call Kennedy and tell him how bad things are and the fact that he must commit American air. You know, he's got to make a full-scale commitment. He passes on that and doesn't talk to Kennedy. And later when he's asked, it was like, well, we didn't really think it. We knew the Cubans were operating aircraft over the beach. We knew we didn't have air cover. We thought we might lose the ship, but we didn't see it as fatal. It's like, that's insane. When the Joint Chiefs of Staff had reviewed the plan, they essentially told the CIA that if there was one Cuban military aircraft operating over the landing, it would take out their landing ships and it would be all over. And that's exactly what happened. But at the very last, actually, JFK actually approved U.S. jets to fly off the command ship Exeter to carry out strikes over the beach and either, you know, enable the Cubans to keep fighting, or actually what it looks like is he expected the Navy to evacuate them, which is what he had directly ordered. We have a document saying from Kennedy saying that if this landing encounters any serious opposition, you have to have a plan to evacuate the total force and land it somewhere else later. They never prepared any plan of that sort. But he did authorize the jet strikes over the beach, and what happened was the Navy got its timing. Well, we don't know exactly. Let's just say that the American pilots flew in. The Navy did not show up to give them cover as they were supposed to. The American pilots got shot down, and it was a tragedy.
Now, that is a far cry from the popular story that's attached to this, which is simply that, you know, Kennedy didn't call in or refused to authorize or whatever the airstrikes. You just said four times there that he authorized the use of, well, okay, Americans can fly Cuban planes. Okay, now dispatch some of our planes. He authorized these things.
He went even further. He off on the second day after they knocked out the ships. Well, two things happened. The Cuban Air Force knocked out one of the ships that had a lot of ammunition on it, which is a real problem. Mm-hmm. But because the Cubans were operating over the beachhead and there was no fighter support, even the B-26, the anti-Castro pilots were found for ground strikes. They weren't flying fighters. They were flying ground attack aircraft. And so the Cuban pilots were successful in enemy cases in shooting them down. They actually put so much, the ships, the landing ships, the transport, were crewed by Cuban, not Cuban volunteer military. They were crewed by commercial crewmen who essentially had been hijacked in New Orleans and told that their ships were going to the Bay of Pigs, and they were going to support this, but it was okay, but it would be safe. When they started getting attacked, they fled to sea and did not stop. And it was only the Navy who stopped one ship 100 miles off the coast and another almost 200 and forced them back. And so it's a very complex situation. Those ships never made it back to unload. That gets to be very convoluted. If they had stayed where they were and managed to unload at night, it could have been a different story. But Kennedy even authorized the United States Air Force to conduct a series of transport airdrops. Forget the Cuban flyers, the Air Force. And they were supposed to conduct a major resupply mission over the beach. It did not happen. And later on, when somebody asked, why didn't it happen? Well, we didn't have enough crews to rig the parachutes to drop the supplies. That's not Kennedy's fault.
Yikes.
you know,
not only that, but resupply, evacuation, and various missions that involved either American airmen or just completely, you know, not only American airmen, but, you know, planes, is a far cry from the story that's normally told here. Now, was it a failure? Yes. But, you know, by whose design now? Because it sounds to me like you're making the argument, and in the book, you're making the argument that Kennedy was, you know, the story that's been told about him all this time. I mean, generally, you know what I'm saying here. They've always kind of said, well, either he didn't do it, or he refused to authorize, or he promised it and then denied it, you know, and therefore was just let these guys die on the beach. Well, evacuation, resupply, you know, involving assets of the U.S. military, whether they be Air Force or Navy, allowing American pilots to fly Cuban planes doesn't sound like that to me, Larry.
No, and it went further than that. The only thing that he absolutely refused, at the last gasp, the admiral who was on the command ship went head-to-head with the president and said, I want to attack Cuba. I need to deploy my aircraft, my fighter bombers, and there's a big question about why even had fighter bombers on the carrier. I want to go up against the Cuban military. We can't save the guys on the beaches unless you let me take out the Cuban military who's attacking them, which would obviously have been an act of war. You know, that's pretty clear. If you send a U.S. Navy carrier into battle against Cuba, you have declared war on them.
Right.
That Kennedy would not go for that, which legally we would expect him not to, because only Congress is supposed to authorize that sort of thing.
Well, so yeah, this is before
that is one order that he gave. He absolutely denied the admiral the order to use his aircraft in a general attack. Now, I have talked to a guy who was on the Essex, who told me that every night they watch the destroyer screen from that Essex group go in towards the beach and shell Cuba. That wasn't supposed to happen, but it did. And every morning after daylight, they'd come steaming out, and they'd replenish their ammunition, and they'd refuel them, and they'd go back in. So there were a lot of things going on that were more commitment than you even might think. But I want to make clear, there was one order that Kennedy would not give. He would not go to full commitment of U.S. forces against the Cuban military.
Okay, hold on, though, because there's another part of this story that I think you're underplaying here that nobody ever mentions. in order to have these, okay, so you have these ships steaming in and, you know, shelling Cuba, right, for lack of a better term here.
After dark,
and you have somebody asking to fly bombers off of an air carrier. That means that there were naval assets very close to the island of Cuba. That means that they were right there. I mean, they weren't, you know, flying them from Florida to go hit Cuba, right?
Absolutely. There was an aircraft carrier and a destroyer screen, the Essex Group, Task Force Alpha, which we wouldn't even know this in the detail that we know it. It's amazing that we only know what really happened with this Navy task group because it was written up in a Navy journal about 20 years ago as just kind of a history of the Navy at the Bay of Pigs. Uh-huh. And goes into a lot of detail that was never in print before that time, that the Navy guys knew about, but had never made it into the histories. And so there was a Navy group there. It was, and here's an interesting thing. That Navy group was authorized by Kennedy. The CIA requested it. They requested a screen to essentially screen off the brigade ships as they sailed towards Cuba, to make sure that they weren't intercepted or somebody didn't stumble across them. All makes perfect sense. An admiral assigned a Navy task group to do that. But it was a little different, I think, than Kennedy fully understood. They flew off all of the aircraft that were on the ship. It was normally an anti-submarine task group for had patrol aircraft and some attack aircraft. They flew on a group of Navy ground attack bombers. And one of the things that the crew noticed was they changed the entire ammunition load for the carrier. They put on all sorts of bombs, missiles, everything that you would need to conduct a major ground attack exercise. Not just to screen the brigade ships. That carrier went to Cuba equipped to go to war against Cuba.
Well, the bombers themselves, something that is, you know, generally talked about as a bomber, that's not what you're going to use to, you know, screen away the pesky, you know, ship that stumbles upon the Cuban group or to, you know, intercept Cuban, you know, the Cuban military's assets, maybe intercepting the group. You don't need bombers for that. You know,
A very specially qualified squadron. I mean, this was the cream of the crop. These guys, if you wanted to fight a ground war, this is the group you would send. So, no, this is not – it's the wrong complement for the tasking. And I think it's probably a good time to bring in the other thing we've learned. And, okay, two things that we do know. We know that there was a lot going on with the Navy – that we didn't know, because what came up during the official investigations is all the papers, all the orders, all the communication logs, all the operational logs for the command ship Essex were burned and destroyed at sea before the Essex ever left the operational area off Cuba. And
no.
That conceals a whole lot, and it appears that what it conceals is the fact that there was actually another, even larger carrier group operating off Cuba, not with just a Navy escort carrier, but with a Navy super carrier, the Independence, accompanied by a Marine Expeditionary Force.
Okay, what would the difference be between the carrier we're talking about that has all these, you know, complements on it that do not necessarily comport with the mission at hand? What is the difference between that carrier and a supercarrier?
The Essex would be the type of carry the type of weapons and aircraft that you need to deal with anti-submarine warfare. Locate Soviet submarines and sink them. Mm-hmm. The Independence is the kind of carrier with the aircraft and the weapons on it that you would use to go to war with conventional military forces.
Like a naval vessel that attacks from a coastline, any nation, pretty
yeah.
much, where they have planes, they have the ability to fire from the ship directly, they have all that stuff, plus they have a more diverse group of aircraft, probably, in order to conduct different types of missions.
And at the time, normally super carriers would be kind of like our strategic carrier groups these days. I mean, they would also, I'm not saying that they did carry this to Cuba, but normally they would be carrying atomic weapons and be part of the PSYOP, the strategic attack plan. You deployed carriers like the Independence around the globe as part of our strategic war power. That would not be true for the Essex.
So that there is readiness in different regions to at any time go to a full-scale war, even though it might be just the preliminary rounds of it. But you could begin the attack of a nation in relatively short time because these things are deployed across the planet. I mean, am I misrepresenting
yeah,
this?
More than begin. Let's actually, in the months before it had been, before it sailed apparently to Cuba, which has been disguised, it was out of Norfolk. It had been stationed off Guantanamo for a time. And let's just put it this way. The Independence by itself could have taken Cuba. I mean, it's like, you know, it's there because if the Cubans do something really stupid and attack Guantanamo, we're just going to resolve the whole issue right now.
Okay. Well, Cuba's a relatively small country, though. So yeah, I can imagine that. But what I'm saying is, you know, to attack any nation, you could begin it with one of these carriers.
Absolutely.
You know, any size, indeed. It would definitely serve as the opening rounds in a full scale war, and had everything from, you know, the type of stuff that is there to, strafe Navy assets to, as you mentioned, you know, literally nuclear bombers, right? Like they could have, launched any of that, anywhere from one to the other in between. You know,
the independence group would be equivalent to now when the president says we're sending one of our carrier strike groups to the Gulf, you know, as a strategic deployment. Mm-hmm. Deploying the independence would have been on that order.
Okay, fair enough. No, I just want to make sure that we're clear on this, because if you're, you know, look, that means that somebody, not saying who necessarily, but somebody had in their mind. See, now that this is where the mythology maybe isn't such a myth. Somebody had in their mind that America was going to invade Cuba here. Somebody had in their mind that, you know, America was going to affect regime change, you know, across the board here. Doesn't necessarily mean the president thought that. It doesn't necessarily mean that the, you know, all of the Joint Chiefs knew exactly everything here.
And the fascinating thing, Chuck, is none of this appears in any of the official inquiries. I mean, the independence is invisible. Okay. All we know is that they are frustrated. It does show up the fact that the Essex destroyed all of its records. And that's kind of frustrating for the investigation, because that also allows them not to clear up the fact of why the Navy didn't support the attack it was supposed to. But, the interesting thing is in the naval story that I told you about, it writes about Admiral Burke making deployments, and it also writes about Admiral Burke requesting to launch airstrikes against Cuba from both the Exeter and the Independence. And when I read that, immediately what struck me is, like, Admiral Burke is going to launch an airstrike against Cuba from Norfolk? That really doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe that carrier was a little closer to Cuba than we thought. And then I went and looked up Admiral Burke's oral history, in which the Navy was kind enough to give me, in which Admiral Burke says, you know, being experienced in this kind of thing, I was afraid those guys might get in trouble down there. And I wasn't supposed to do it, but I sent a group down there to be ready in case they did.
No kidding. So that's clearly not the support group that everybody knew about. That's got to be something other.
Bissell may have known about that. I don't think Kennedy did.
See, there you go. But either way, Kennedy wasn't willing to go full on into it and declare war on his own. You see, we got to remember, this is before the reality of the War Powers Act, right? So the president really wasn't supposed to do this kind of thing. You know, there was a limitation there, right?
Back when we actually thought there was a separation of powers.
Oh, right. Okay, this just checking. Because you got to take that into account. Legally, the president couldn't do that. That would have been an overreach from his office. The executive branch wasn't supposed to do things like that. And
you even wonder why the admiral would even, it's like, no, the man's not going to tell me to do that. Yeah, let's face it. If he had wanted to do that, why would not he have just done that? If I wanted to send the Navy against Cuba, why not just do it? You know, why not, you know, just in any event, but bottom line.
You actually spoiled my question, by the way, because I was going to say to you, if that was the case, if this was the intent of Kennedy, if this was the intent of everybody involved, right, to just, okay, we're going to bulldoze Cuba, basically, right? We're going to affect regime change because we're going to, you know, absolutely, eviscerate the government. We're going to destroy their military in one fell swoop. If that was the intent, you wouldn't bother with this Cuban landing force. you wouldn't bother with this convoluted idea of raising up a, you know, popular resistance. I mean, you might have sought to do that in the aftermath once you've completely, you know, crippled any command and control from the Cuban government. If you destroyed the central Cuban government completely, then you might want to have your guerrillas ready to go in and sort of organize the people as if they're part of the new movement in the country, maybe. But you wouldn't have gone through this whole other thing to begin with, right?
Save them for an occupation force. But it evolved in a very strange way. And something I think we've got to bring up here is that, you know, at different points in the Cuba project, what was supposed to be going on changed. And that's why it really does it a disservice to talk about it as if the Bay of Pigs reflected everything. Or even you brought up something before that thought of an insurgency. You know, an insurgency was a big thing in up to November. Then it went away. And then when they started having meetings with Kennedy, they would talk about, you know, this will probably stimulate an insurgency. And it was kind of like, okay, fine. But when you look at what the CIA folks themselves are saying, they had no intelligence that there was an insurgency or would be a big resistance movement to join it. And all of the people involved in the Bay of Pigs, Easterline, Hawkins, Lynch, down actually offshore, are all quoted as saying, we had nothing, absolutely nothing, to indicate that there would be a major insurgency in conjunction with this.
Well, and here's the other thing I need to ask before we run out of time. Because if you were to attempt to encourage an insurgency by this grand display of the landing on the beach, let's just say that that plan is legitimate and is coherent. Wouldn't it stand to reason that there would be evidence of a propaganda effort, leafleting literally dropping pieces of paper on the public? Wouldn't there have been radio broadcasts, stuff that happened well in advance as a primer for raising a popular resistance movement, encouraging it, generating it, ginning it up in any way, shape, or form previous to this landing? Is there any evidence that you see of a coordinated effort to do that? Because strategically, Larry, it only makes sense that that would happen, right or wrong?
Elements of that had started occurring months before, but, you know, they started the radio broadcast in the summer of 60. And by basically their documents that say, you know, we kept telling them that something was happening and the resistance movement was growing and everybody on the island could see that it wasn't happening. And so that by November, nobody believed the radio broadcast anymore. Then they managed to actually make a few leaflet drops over the winter and nothing happened. So by the time this actually happened in April, those things all have to be synchronized. If you're telling the populace there is a resistance and insurgency and it never, ever happens, and then suddenly you tell them again, why would they believe you?
Well, not only do you have to have that, but you have to receive intelligence in return that shows that this is being received. This is, I'm again bringing it down to a very basic level, but, just strategically, again, not only do you have to coordinate that to make sure that, you know, you strike when the iron's hot, right? But you also have to have some indication in return that it's working.
The reason I laughed is obviously they inquired into this in the inquiries. And basically the response would be something like, well, we did manage to sneak a B-26 in and we dropped, you know, 5 tons of leaflets out in the countryside because it's way too dangerous to fly off over the cities. And so we did drop 5 tons of leaflets there, and we dropped another 5 tons someplace else. And so the question then was, well, what happened to them? And the answer was, we don't know. We just dropped them. Like, okay, did anybody catch them? Did they pass them out? Did anybody in the cities ever see them? We don't know. No intelligence ever came back. Castro, one thing I did not say in this conversation, Chuck, that I ought to say is Hawkins warned everyone that if this thing did not happen by March 1st, at the rate that Castro was using Soviet military and his own security people to roll up all the on-island resistance. And by the way, he totally collapsed the on-island resistance in February, March.
Right.
And CIA knew it. So they knew there was no resistance there to help. Basically, Hawkins said, if you don't launch this landing by March 1st, please do not do it because it's impossible. So again, twice he warns them, and no, it didn't launch by March 1st. It was another 6 weeks later. The security was intense. And so that just, I'm trying to answer your question by, yeah, they did try some of those things, but they really had no idea any of it was working and no reason to think it was working.
So the return intelligence, which is important to find out what the impact of the propaganda or the PSYOP is, was not even there.
Nope.
So,
and the IG, the IG and the historian actually looked at that and looked for those reports because this was a big deal. In the Taylor Commission, there was a lot of talk about of what you were saying. Well, we thought it would stimulate the resistance. So the IG and the historian looked for intel documents that were coming back off the island that would have supported that. And they, each of them say in their reports, they could find no intelligence coming off the island that supported that.
Well, I'll tell you one other thing is that, you know, and the title of the book is In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Okay. But it's another fascinating thing here. Just the use of the word secret is another aspect here, because this wasn't a very well-kept secret. Now, I know I've been unfair by holding that one until the very end here, but quite frankly, that's almost comical. I mean, you got the question mark after tanks, right? But but the other funny part is here, just the word secret. Involved in this, I mean, sure, the average Joe walking around on the streets in America didn't hear about the Bay of Pigs until the Bay of Pigs happened. But it wasn't a very well-kept secret, from my understanding as well. So you've got propaganda where you don't know what the return is or there is no return. You have indications that the resistance, as it might have stood, was basically collapsed. You have, you know, give me more assets. They cut them in half. It almost makes me want to ask what went right here regarding this entire operation. But we don't have time for that because, again, we're down to the last few minutes here. Larry, I think we're going to have another discussion about this book. I'm just telling you now. But for now, how do we wrap this up? I mean, I'm only halfway through, and I'm telling you right now, dense amount of information, extremely diverse cross-section of resources, or sources, I should say, not resources. I'm thinking about resources because the way they were deployed in a raid is laughable for this operation. And it's very interesting the way that people have carried on about the Bay of Pigs and have made it seem like a particular set of circumstances that pretty much, I mean, you're removing any sort of faith I had in any of those stories I've always been told about it in this book, which is funny because I think you feel as though you only made a few points. But when you take a look at the overall picture you're pointing in this book, a painting, excuse me, in this book, I think anybody that thinks they understand the Bay of Pigs needs to rethink it and read this book. So, again, it's called In Denial. I'll give you the link to the Amazon page where you can get it. It'll be available by the time this podcast is available. And that'll be, well, let's see, the 17th of the month here. But I'm speaking to you on the 16th, right? Anyway, doesn't matter. Larry, I give you the last couple of minutes to sort of put a bow on this, as I say. Because this is a real gift. In Denial, secret wars with airstrikes and tanks, it does really tell you a whole different story about the Bay of Pigs. But, Larry, your last words here, you got about 5 minutes or so to work with.
I think the big question, when you finish reading all about the evolution of the Cuba Project, the phases it went through, all of the issues with it, you start asking yourself, you know, okay, you can find 101 reasons why it didn't work. But what jumps out at you is that so many people knew that it was in so much trouble. How was it allowed to continue? And how, if Richard Bissell was kind of the, you know, he was the head of the project, and he did not say stop. He did not even when he had the opportunity to call Kennedy and say, look, we need not to land. There was time not to land the group, when they learned that the advanced airstrikes had only taken out half of the Cuban Air Force. Why did he not call things off at certain points? How could he possibly believe it would succeed? And that's maybe one of the big open questions about this. How do you get so obsessed about an operation, and how does it get so much inertia that you continue to do it when any objective viewer would go, stop now? That's one of the questions it raises about all secret warfare and all deniable warfare. How do you get yourself into these things that you just literally refuse to stop? Kind of like the United States and Laos. Mm-hmm. Kind of like that's a big part of what the book addresses is how does that process work? What's really going on? And that I carry that far beyond just the Cuba Project, because I look at projects over 40 some years for the U.S. and in contemporary projects for Russia and China and Iran. But there's one chapter when you do read the book that I recommend to everybody. It's a chapter I put in by, I call it Hidden Measures, and perhaps I should have called it Hail Mary, because list three or four things that Bissell did within the last 3 weeks before the landings that if any one of them had worked, it might have saved the whole thing. It would involve different plans or different attempts to assassinate Castro. Without Castro, the whole picture could have been different. The possibility of provocation exercise that simulated a Cuban attack on Guantanamo and allowed the independents to go ahead and launch. There are other things that could have been a play, but the thing is, they were all done in the last minute, the very last minute, only weeks ahead, and they all failed only days ahead, and which brings up a really, you know, tragic scenario. Like, well, when your Hail Mary pass failed, do you still go ahead? Do you still send those guys onto the beach? And the answer was, yeah, I did.
You know, here's the thing about a tragedy, though, Larry, and that is that usually you can see at the beginning of the story that things are going to turn out badly. And the fascinating part of it usually is to try and figure out why it is that those involved are still pursuing what is obviously going to end in disaster. And so tragedy is a great word here, because you have a lot of people that should have known better, that should have said, you know what, call it off, do something different. You know, do nothing would have maybe been better. I'm sure the Cubans on the beach would have agreed that doing nothing might have been better than this. You know, but I'm guessing, I guess there. Who knows? Either way, it is remarkable. Do you get into, because I haven't finished the book yet, but do you actually talk about the why in this? Like the why Bissell did what he did, really? Or do we not know that? I mean, you can answer that any way you want or not answer it, Larry, because I'm only going to give you a couple seconds.
I do speculate that in the chapter on Hidden Measures. I speculate what might have led him, but I also speculate. I have quite a bit of time that I spend on why the people that are in charge of any of these projects get so obsessed that they continue past the part of sanity. you could say the same thing for Ted Shackley and Laos. Right. And I go into that in detail. Why does someone who sees everything they're doing failing continue to recommend doing even more and more? Say the same thing for Henry Kissinger. You know, there's the psychology to it that I try to address in the book.
Well, there were certain points in the history of Vietnam where, you know, the Vietnam conflict, right, where that's exactly what was going on. You know, why is this failing? Well, you know why it's failing? Because we need to do more of it. Seem to be part, seriously, though. I mean, I'm not kidding.
Yeah,
right?
You're right. It's like, if that didn't work, let's do more of it. It's like, Miss Moreland goes, oh, let's just double the artillery bombardment. Okay, well, all right. The artillery bombardment didn't work at all, but if we double it, okay, sure.
Exactly. Once again, the book is In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. It does focus quite a bit on the Bay of Pigs, but tells you a lot about, oh, I don't know, maybe the general attitude in operations that you could relate to the Bay of Pigs. Larry Hancock is the author, larry-hancock.com, and I have a feeling we're going to have a whole other episode discussing this book when I'm done with it. But until tomorrow, anyway, remember that I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.